a book club and podcast for anyone who wants to explore the best mysteries and thrillers ever written. I'm your host, Sarah Harrison.
And I'm your host, Carolyn Daughters. Pour yourself a tea or a gin and tonic.
But not a toxin.
No, and join us on a journey through 19th and 20th century mysteries and thrillers, every one of them a game changer.
Carolyn.
Sarah.
Do we have a sponsor today?
We do have a sponsor today. Who is our sponsor?
Was it Linden Botanicals?
Ah, that's right. Okay. I had to get reminded there. Thank you very much for that. So our sponsor today is Linden Botanicals. It's a Colorado-based company. Their passion is plant-based health. Through research and global travel, they have identified the best herbal teas and herbal extracts to help people optimize their physical, mental, and emotional health. They believe that education is key, so you can find hundreds of valuable resources at www.lindenbotanicals.com, where they also have their online store where they sell their herbal teas and extracts. And as a bonus, you can get 10% off your first order if you sign up. You would do that at www.lindenbotanicals.com/signup.
I'm drinking out of a sweet Linden Botanicals mug. Is this, like, even available to the public, or how do you get one of these things?
That is a great question. They are not currently available, that I don't believe, but what a great idea. I'm going to mention it to Linden Botanicals and see what they have to say.
I think you should. Yeah. Everyone loves some swag, right?
Yeah, exactly.
We also have a super rad listener of the month.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really excited to mention Beth Roofer from Davenport, Iowa,
mm-hmm.
wrote in through the website and basically made our day.
Mm-hmm.
So, Beth, you're going to receive one of these sweet tea tonic and toxin stickers. That's going to come to you in the mail.
Thanks for listening.
Yeah, thank you so much for listening. Not just for listening, but for actually telling us that you were listening. So.
Yes, because if you're just listening, we don't always know you're listening. But she came
yeah.
forward and let us know, so we appreciate that.
We actually never know if you're listening.
Yeah, so. except for our mind reading.
Right? Yeah, well, except for that.
Yeah.
But thank you, Beth, and the sticker is coming to you
mm-hmm.
in the mail. And if any of you other folks want to say, hey, I am actually listening to you guys, you might get a sticker. Mm-hmm. Let us know.
So, Sarah, what are we talking about this month?
Oh, man, we are talking about the Moonstone.
The Moonstone. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I really liked it, I have to say. Mm-hmm. I know you were preferring the woman in white,
mm-hmm.
But I prefer the Moonstone for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we like to start, before we get into the conversation, and this book is just chock full of things to talk about. This is Wilkie Collins. It's our second Wilkie Collins novel. If you've had a chance to listen to our podcast episodes on The Woman in White, you know that I'm a huge fan, and really also a fan of this book. And hopefully you have a chance to read both The Woman in White and The Moonstone. But
yeah, read them both.
Mm-hmm. I think they're great reads and in many cases overlooked. So this is like a hearkening back, right? This is like 19th century detective stories where the form was born.
Yeah, and I thought that was really interesting. You mentioned back with The Woman in White, that even though I don't exactly remember what you would call your degree, but like basically Victorian literature. And this wasn't part of it. Wilkie Collins.
It wasn't. I focused on 19th century British novels and just never made it to Wilkie Collins. I have no idea why. I, looking back, can't believe it. And I'm thrilled that I've come to these books now. So, you know, I'm late to the party, but I showed up, so I'm very excited about that. So we want to, you know, we have a lot of things we want to talk about here, but what we want to do, because some of you've read the book, some of you haven't read it yet, hopefully you will still read it, but we like to give you a brief summary of what we're going to talk about. And we're going to do two different podcast episodes and break them up into the two parts of this book. So the book has a part one and a part two.
Yeah.
First period and a second period. And so I will read, give everybody a little bit of a taste of what happens in the first period. It's called The Loss of the Diamond. Okay, so this is what happens. The Moonstone is a large, magnificent yellow diamond that originally adorned the forehead of the Hindu moon god. It was later looted in southern India in 1799 by Colonel John Herncastle. The stolen gem is said to carry a curse. On returning to England, John Herncastle was ostracized by his family. Possibly out of revenge, we're not sure, he leaves the diamond to his niece, Rachel Verinder, who will inherit it when she turns 18. Rachel's cousin, Franklin Blake, arrives at her home on the Yorkshire coast to deliver the diamond to Rachel on her 18th birthday. Rachel and Franklin grow fond of each other while decorating her sitting room door. That is something that happens in this book.
Yeah, they're painting a door.
For days.
Then leads to love, folks.
It's really a standard pathway. And Rachel's cousin, Godfrey, meanwhile, proposes to her, but she turns him down. Well, Rachel's mother, Lady Verinder, hosts a dinner party on Rachel's 18th birthday. Several guests attend the party, including a local doctor and a famous global traveler named Mr. Murthwaite. At the party, Mr. Murthwaite identifies three Indians seen near the house, and he says they're high-caste Brahmins. Rachel puts the diamond in her bedroom cabinet, the moonstone. She hides it away, but the next morning it's gone. Everyone at the family estate is under suspicion, including Franklin and Godfrey. Turns out the local police are incompetent, so Franklin calls in the celebrated London detective Sergeant Cuff. He realizes the importance of smeared paint on Rachel's sitting room door. We're back to that door.
The door is pivotal to the story.
The smear has been made by an article of clothing whose owner is almost certainly the thief. Well, Rachel obstructs the investigation and cuts off all communication with Franklin. Sergeant Cuff concludes that she has stolen her own diamond with the help of a housemaid, a reformed thief named Rosanna Spearman. Rosanna drowns herself in the local quicksand.
The local quicksand.
Called the Shivering Sand.
Yeah, I would like to find some local quicksand.
Yeah, we've got a lot of that in Colorado. I'll show you. And Lady Verinder dismisses Sergeant Cuff from the case. However, as we'll see in the second period, the second part of the book, Sergeant Cuff correctly predicts many future developments.
Yeah, so I thought this was a really fun book. And I know, like, I complained a lot about the sexism in, like, I felt like sexism was at the root of supporting the plot of The Woman in White, but I didn't really feel like that here. Mm-hmm. Oh, you get some, like you get in Victorian novels, but it wasn't like necessary to the story, so right. to speak. I really enjoyed the book. There was nothing kind of like prohibiting me from that in my own emotional baggage, I guess.
it's a caper. It's like it's a fun mystery. Who did it? How was it done? And it took me by surprise, in particular, the first part, this part that we're talking about mm-hmm. here, I was super engaged and I just turned the pages and just, I went through it really fast. It's not a small book, but it's a fun read. So I read it pretty quickly.
Sweet. No, it's a pretty large book. If you're seeing this video clip, mm-hmm. this is my edition. It's pretty hefty.
Yeah,
we'll get Collins, and then maybe this relates to our first question we're going to talk about, but mm-hmm. Wilkie Collins writes pretty epically large mm-hmm. mysteries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this one is in 32 weekly parts, published in Charles Dickens Magazine all the year round. So, you know, it makes me think that the publication schedule has to have affected the way he structures the book and in each chapter. Right.
Yeah, and maybe, you know, maybe I'm not very attuned to that. Because the same is said of Dickens, like, well, his books are so big because he's, like, paid by the word. Mm-hmm. I'm like, that's true, but also, it's not like there's a bunch of superfluous words, mm-hmm. in my opinion. I think Dickens is just really brilliant. Mm-hmm. tell me what you saw in terms of Wilkie Collins and this kind of size.
There's a lot of, you know, you're on the edge of your seat at the close of each chapter.
Yeah.
So, you know, he leaves you wanting more. And so in a book that is not published in 32 parts and on a weekly basis, you wouldn't necessarily have to end each chapter on a mini cliffhanger, because people are in the book, they just keep reading, you get them hopefully hooked and then they keep reading. He's continually hooking the reader 32 times, and he's really good at it. If you look at the close of each chapter, you see how he grabs you and makes you want to figure out, oh my gosh, what does happen next? And you start on to the next chapter. I think it's quite brilliant what he does.
It really kind of makes me think of like how maybe modern TV structures are created, you know, and sort of we're in this age now of binging. You watch a series, like we're a little bit late. We're still watching through Stranger Things on Netflix. And, you know, each episode, it sort of invites you to be like, what? Mm-hmm. Well, I've got to watch the next episode. Mm-hmm. Although we have to sleep, so we don't. But, you know, I remember season one, we definitely felt that pull to mm-hmm. want to binge the whole thing. And mm-hmm. I know a lot of people who would just binge an entire series in maybe 2 days.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know that it's related, but it's probably certainly related to the concept of serializing the story.
For sure. And so Stranger Things, I don't know how many episodes are in it, but I believe it's a shorter season than some. So
yeah, 9, I think, this season.
So 9, that gives you 9 opportunities to grab people and close out each episode and really like engage you enough that you think, oh my gosh, I'm so tired and the hour's late, but I'm gonna start the next episode. In a more traditional TV series where there might be 18 or 22 episodes, there's often a lot of fluff filler episodes in there, you know, just episodes that don't really move the story forward or don't really take you anywhere. With this weekly serial process that Wilkie Collins was doing, he didn't have that luxury of, let me just throw in a chapter, or I don't have to really end this in any interesting way. Like, he wanted people to jump on that next one or wait for the next weekly part to be published. He wanted that. And so Stranger Things is a good example with 9 episodes where every episode counts. Like, you take one of those episodes out and you've got a problem. Whereas the longer series, not all of them certainly, but many of them, you know, there's some episodes you could probably remove from the season and it wouldn't really impact the season.
Yeah, you know, that actually reminds me of pre-streaming TV. Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. I used to be obsessed in high school, like, before I guess I had a life, you know, it was X-Files.
Oh, yeah.
My Friday nights were X-Files. Mm-hmm. But the very first season of X-Files, as awesome as it was, mm-hmm. The episodes were extremely standalone. Mm-hmm. Like, they didn't even start kind of having a storyline over multiple episodes mm-hmm. until further seasons. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's kind of interesting. I hadn't thought about that before.
Yeah.
Like, when do you need to hook them? How often do you know? Was all the year round, like, monthly, every other week? I'm seeing 32 weekly parts.
I think probably weekly. Yeah.
Weekly.
Yeah.
So it is almost like a TV show.
Yeah.
And you want to kind of make sure your reader comes back to you and doesn't start reading something else.
Mm-hmm. And so if you have a lot of, you know, the sort of flabby middle, which is a problem in a lot of books, right? I mean, if you think about it. Starts really strong and maybe it ends strong, but then in the middle you're just kind of flipping the pages and like, oh, big heavy sigh. he didn't have that luxury because somebody might, you know, say 4 of the chapters in the row and in a row in the middle sort of lose you. You might just put it down. You might just say, I don't even care. Like, I'm not going to keep going with this. So he keeps hooking you over and over and over again. So stylistically, this, I think, really influences the genre. It's an important development, and I think a lot of future writers took notice.
Yeah, speaking of future writers, that made me wonder, actually. So I notice in even just a lot of modern books that I read that the end of the chapter doesn't feel like a closure so much mm-hmm. as trying to get me to read the next chapter. And yeah. then I have a hard time finding a stopping point. Mm-hmm. So, and those aren't serialized. They're just novels published.
Right.
Is that something that you feel like just writers have adopted in general, like always trying to get a chapter to lead to the next chapter, or no?
No, I think it's in part genre specific, and it's in part one author versus another. But in this mystery and thriller genre, I think you want to keep the tension sort of heightened. In a thriller, for example, you'd have the tension heightened for quite a while, but you can't have it a 10 out of 10 the entire book because there's no way to elevate. There's no way to really, raise the stakes. So you keep it sort of elevated low, 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 and then something happens. And I think it's part of this genre and form, and some other genres probably have also adopted it, or I would argue some specific writers in some other genres.
Yeah, no, I think you make a good point. Maybe it's just for a tension elevating
mm-hmm.
technique, which is awesome. You know, mm-hmm. my brain doesn't function at that point mm-hmm. yet. So I'm going to apply this technique to my storytelling.
Yeah.
Like that seems really clever.
Yeah. it is. I think it is very clever. And I think Wilkie Collins really mastered this skill and really showed a lot of other writers how you could do it. And then one of the cool things, I think you're really interested in this in particular, but he harkens back to other writers, in particular, Robinson Crusoe. He's looking at he's quoting from, Defoe's book. He's liberally, or one of his characters is Gabriel Betteredge.
I do. I love that. I love when old books reference old books. Mm-hmm. We talked about kind of our old book club.
Mm-hmm.
And those books would do it a lot. They'd reference some of the great writers mm-hmm. That maybe influenced their times. The way that Betteredge referenced Robinson Crusoe was in a very biblical manner, mm-hmm. which kind of lended some humor to it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I know an eighth grader right now who was assigned to read Robinson Crusoe over the summer and like write something about it. And I was like, oh, I know. Here's a weird angle. There's this other book that references it all the time. And I like that now too. I'm going to pull up a book if you're in our future video audience.
Yeah.
This is the Big Bow Mystery. Mm-hmm. And it references another book we've read. It references a lot of murders in the Rue Morgue. Throughout it, and I thought that's really cool.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the way that Betteredge references it is a way that you see, and I think this was done intentionally, mm-hmm. that you hear maybe a lot of people use their Bible. Like they'll just randomly open to a spot and kind of like trust that the Lord is leading them to read something mm-hmm. important that day.
Mm-hmm.
And so Betteredge does this all the time. He's not even like reading it as a story. He's just doing his Robinson Crusoe reading
yeah.
of the day,
yes.
like what he's reading. And then he treats it very prophetically. Like what is it? How is this applying in sort of a, I don't know, like a philosophical, providential guidance,
right.
prophetical way
right.
to the events of his life. I thought that was...
And he's
really
he's,
interesting.
He's at the so Gabriel Betteredge is one of the narrators. The book it has a number of different narrators.
Yes.
Gabriel Betteredge, at the beginning of the book, says he quotes from Robinson Crusoe. Now I saw, though too late, the folly of beginning a work before we count the cost and before we judge rightly of our own strength to go through with it.
Which that in itself is actually like a paraphrase of a biblical quote. That was really funny.
But it's also sort of a meta statement of the mm-hmm. book that we're about to read, because it's about this moonstone that in 1799, you know, this British colonel, you know, took from India. And, you know, now I saw, though too late, the folly of beginning a work. And so you get this sense of sort of prophetic about what we're about to read.
Mm-hmm.
Like, looking back, you know, maybe we would have all done something differently, or maybe we would have, you know, who knows? But so the quotes are, I think, aptly chosen.
Yes. I mean, definitely. He uses it in a way that it certainly works for how Bettridge used Robinson Crusoe. And it made me think, I want to go back and reread that. It's been a long time since I read it.
Me too.
I remember loving it. Mm-hmm. And now, like, I think, what was it? Who is the character that the guy with the black and white hair. Mm-hmm. Bettridge kind of judged him harshly for having not read Robinson Crusoe since he was a kid.
Oh, is it Ezra Jennings?
Yeah, Ezra Jennings. Yeah. I'm like, oh, that's me. I read it as a kid, and I'm not referring to it every day anymore.
But then, a lot of people probably haven't read Robinson Crusoe. So the Moonstone is expecting readers to have that reference point.
Yeah. Well, that's one thing I liked about this eighth grader school. Mm. I was like, oh, they're still reading books like this. That's awesome, because I feel like it has a lot to contribute.
Yeah.
You know, and like, we're still reading Murders in the Rue Morgue, which the Big Bow Mystery quotes. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we thought about it, like, wondering, are there books that do you regularly quote from? I know I do have books that I regularly quote from.
Mm. Sometimes from The Four Agreements. I really like that book. I quote...
Any fictional books?
I quote from John Milton sometimes.
Oh, yeah, like what?
Just some of his poems and maybe some lines from Paradise Lost. I took a class as an undergrad where... we would sit in a circle each day and take turns reading from... It was a course on John Milton, but there's a poem, my favorite poem of John Milton's is a poem called When I Consider. But I don't know, just not from fiction usually, but maybe more from poets.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah, what do you quote from?
Definitely fiction.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Like, I'm obsessed with fiction. That's why, you know, always I'm wanting to do these book clubs where we read these great, pivotal type books. You may not agree with me here, but one book I quote from a lot is Dune. All right.
Yeah.
I love Dune on like this deep level to the point. All right, so I'm giving birth to my two children and like, one of my mantras that I would write down and say to myself is the Litany Against Fear.
I like the Litany
from Dune. Well, it's brilliant. Mm-hmm. And then
that's the I shall not fear. And
fear is the mind killer. Yeah. Fear is the little death.
Yeah.
It's great stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, you let your fear wash over you and through you, and it's gone. Only I will remain. No, there's the Litany Against Fear, but there's a lot of actual stuff from Dune, even to the concept of like the sleeper awakening, which again is a paraphrase of a biblical quote. But I think a lot about fiction in terms of things I take with me.
Well, so Gabriel Betteridge also, you know, he plays a pivotal role in the first part of the book. He really does.
Pivotal and amusing. You have to like Gabriel. He's a character that's hard to dislike.
He's a character. But at one point, he's telling the story of the Moonstone, but he's integrating, weaving in his own story. And he says, I'm asked to tell the story of the diamond, and instead I've been telling the story of my own self. I wonder whether the gentlemen who make a living out of writing books ever find their own selves getting in the way of their subjects. And I think that's I loved that quote, which is why I pulled that one out. But I think it's inevitable. Our view of the world, the way we see the world, necessarily informs the way we tell a story, I think.
I agree with that. You know, I was looking at this question and I was thinking about it in two ways. You know? So in what ways, and I kind of paraphrase it, in what ways do we bring ourselves kind of like just into the things we're talking about? And I was like, in every way, we humans make everything about ourselves.
Yes.
You know, that's kind of like one of our more annoying traits. But then I was thinking about the Moonstone. I was like, I wonder how on earth, thinking that Wilkie Collins wrote this, and probably resonates with him. Mm-hmm. But in terms of this kind of wild story, I was like, well, what in the world is he doing? What parts of Wilkie Collins are kind of getting in the way of him writing this story? I don't really know. But you're an actual writer. And so I kind of thought maybe you would have some insight into that. How do you get in the way of your stories you tell, like fictional stories?
I don't know. Getting in the way maybe is one way to phrase it. Or, you know, the way you influence, your view of the world influences the story you tell. Even in the selection of who the hero is. Mm. Is this person the hero or is that? Whose point of view am I going to share? Whose point of view do I obviously identify with, consciously or unconsciously? How do I tell this story? From whose perspective? What details do I share? We do that in our day-to-day lives when we tell stories. So, you know, if we're the hero of our own story, then, you know, somebody else might be the villain of that story, but certainly the villain of our story, you know, we're talking about whatever the experiences we've had, that villain in turn, when they're telling their family and friends the story, probably have that reversed, right? They're the hero of their story.
Yeah, no, I like that. And that feels, I can kind of feel that on two levels. Mm. Now that you put it that way, mm-hmm. I think about Wilkie Collins as heroes. And mm. we were just talking about this a little earlier, mm-hmm. where, you know, Franklin Blake is the hero and Walter Hartwright was the hero of the woman. And I don't like either of those guys. Yeah. And I'm struggling with Wilkie Collins. I just keep wondering, like, mm-hmm. does he believe they're great? Mm-hmm. Or is this like tongue in cheek? Because these guys kind of suck.
Right.
So there's like sort of the literary level there.
Right.
But then there's, the stupid story I was just telling you earlier where I forgot to bring my wallet to the grocery store. Mm-hmm. And the grocery store had all of these really inane rules about why I couldn't pay for stuff. Uh-huh. I couldn't enter my credit card manually. I couldn't, you know, write a check without an ID. And I was like, oh, this is so stupid. Mm-hmm. And I'm seeing myself standing in the line, just really put upon mm-hmm. by these grocery store rules. And also, like, really aware that I'm being a pain in the butt to everyone else in line yeah. and this poor grocery store clerk yeah. because I can't pay for my groceries according to, like, standard methods. And so really trying to not, mm-hmm. Like, moan about it. I basically apologized to everyone I was interacting with for being such a pain in the butt, yeah. even though in my mind I felt like a real martyr over it.
So you're in it, right? Like right. you're in it and you're feeling it and you're angry. But then on the flip side, you can see it from other perspectives. And that awareness, I think, is it's not as common as maybe, you know, we would all.
Well, I could see myself easily being the hero of my story mm-hmm. and railing against these clerks for their stupid grocery store rules that they didn't write.
Yeah.
And simultaneously then becoming the villain mm-hmm. of everyone else's story. Because yes. here's this, like, entitled woman who sure. is just taking up space, who forgot her wallet and is acting so righteous about it.
Feels like she should still be able to just march out with her groceries.
Right? I should, though. But but I'm not going to play that part. I play the part of, I'm sorry I'm yeah. holding you up here. But, yeah, I could totally see that. Being simultaneously my own hero and someone else's villain.
Right. You know, so sticking with Gabriel Betteredge for a minute, because he's so instrumental to the first part of this, of the Moonstone. At one point he says, gentlefolk have it tough because they spend their time searching for something to do. He says, quote, thank your stars that your head has got something it must think of and your hands have something they must do. So, and he also writes, people in high life have the luxury of indulging their feelings. People in low life have no such privilege. Necessity, which spares our betters, has no pity on us. We learn to put our feelings back into ourselves and to jog on with our duties. And I thought this was so interesting because he is a servant. That is his profession, his job, his lifelong identity. He lives in this household. He supports the family, the Verinder family. Very respectful and all of that, and trusted and trustworthy.
He really loves them. Like, he loves them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's what, like, modern parlance, I would call him, like, a company man. Mm-hmm. Like, I worked my last company. Mm. You would have folks that were there since they were 18. Wow. And they're going to retire there.
Wow.
And they're there for life, and whatever they feel, you know, they're very loyal to the company.
Yeah. And so I thought, you know, there are many times, just to you know, put it out there, that I'm not thankful my head is something it must think of, and I'm not thankful my hands have something they must do. And he's referencing, like, the leisure time of these wealthy people. They fritter it away. They just, you know, do I want to sit in this chair? Do I want to move to the veranda? Do I want to paint the door today? Like, they've got nothing going
on. Right. It's like, the most important thing is dressing for dinner versus, like, morning dress.
Yes.
You know, like, which cravat do I put on?
Should I stroll the grounds before I put on my cravat?
What recipe am I using for my paint here? That was actually super pivotal to the plot. Was the paint recipe.
And it seemed like, you know, two of the, you know, upper crust characters, Franklin and Rachel, paint this door. It went on and on and on. And I just thought, my gosh, like, this is truly the only thing they have to do is
true.
To
they
paint
have
this door.
Leisure.
Yeah. And, you know, so he says, well, you know, be thankful you have something to do. And there are many times where, you know, to be honest, I am not thankful. And I look upon people who have all of this leisure time and freedom and so forth. And I feel, you know, a little put upon, like, oh, poor me. Like, I've got so much to do and they have so much free time. You know, whatever that story is that we tell ourselves, right? So, it was a good observation, I think, on his part. That, you know, he personally, Gabriel Betteredge, appreciates having something to do to fill his time and, you know, and his thoughts and so forth.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And I felt the same way, especially when you see stupid stories in the news about super rich people making terrible, wasteful decisions with their lives. And you just think, oh my goodness, if I had this money and time, I have a list of things I'd like to get started on.
Yeah.
That would be super interesting. And I really think that's true, but it does sort of make you pause and wonder and say, is that true?
Right.
You know, is there just a couple different kinds of people, like some very proactive and some that need more structure? Or does having a lot of wealth and leisure sort of breed
complacency
and
just like, yeah, because, you know, say I came into a fortune tomorrow, I'd like to think that I would keep writing, that I would be supporting organizations that are meaningful to me, that I would be sharing the wealth with people I cared about. But it's possible I would just go retire to Fiji. You know,
like, yeah,
you just
kind of wonder. And I think, you know, you and I weren't raised to be super wealthy. So we have developed maybe a structural mentality that if we were given a lot of leisure, you know, tomorrow, we would probably still be very active.
Yeah.
Where if you have generational wealth, it probably takes a whole different kind of structuring to keep up some activity there.
Yeah.
But I do have to say, you know, when you kind of put it this way, there's definitely been times in my life where I'm like, thank goodness I have this job to go to take my mind off my life, because my life was just in shambles at that time. And having a job and having that structure could just let me compartmentalize and focus. Mm-hmm. Whereas if I didn't have that, I probably would have just, like, laid on the floor and fallen apart for months.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, if you take a step back and you're not, like, too deep into it, you can see that, yes, maybe it is a gift to have the desire or even the need to be productive and to do productive work, to work with your hands, to use your head, to have something better and more to do each day than paint a door.
Painting's one of the things I'd love to do more of
my time. But I would like to think that, you know, a year later you'd have more to show than one door.
Yes.
Unless this was a major project of yours and you're like, you won't believe this door when I'm done and this is my passion project.
And then
in which case
smudge it. yeah, with your thievery.
So I'm interested in talking about the women in this book. There are so many interesting, diverse female characters in this book.
There are some really interesting ones, and I did like them.
Mm-hmm.
I liked them a bit. I mean, I liked them and I disliked them.
Mm-hmm.
They were interesting, and it was interesting, again, going back to what is the narrator's perspective here?
Mm-hmm.
On the women. I feel like you can sense favoritism, but I don't always agree with mm-hmm. what it feels like the author's telling me I should feel about these people. So I always wonder, is he really telling me that?
Or, yeah.
You know, am I just reading into it?
I felt like, okay, so there's Miss Clack. So she's, you know, she's sanctimonious and also...
She's the second narrator.
And she's very, she can be funny, intentionally so, and also not intentionally
yes, so. I really liked Miss Clack.
Yes.
I have to say, I really did like her.
I mean, Rachel Verinder is called, unlike other girls her age, she's spirited. But, you know, I feel like the narrator had to tell us that because we didn't really have an opportunity to witness that.
That's true. But we don't witness a lot of other girls her age except for her mm-hmm. two cousins, which are kind of giggly and screechy.
Right.
Which
is now how I'm going to refer to them, giggly and screechy.
But I could kind of, you know, I see that. It is one of those things, kind of like with Woman in White, where I have a little bit of baggage around that phrase. Mm. A lot of people have told me, like, oh, you're not like other girls. And I'm like, I don't know what you mean by that.
Right.
I'm perfectly fine as a girl.
Why
you, like, your compliment is simultaneously insult to mm-hmm. womankind.
Mm-hmm.
So, mm-hmm. but nevertheless, people say that, and they do say it about things mm-hmm. like being direct or yeah. being logical mm-hmm. or those sorts of traits. And in this case, I think for Rachel, they were saying it about the way she sort of kept her own counsel. Mm-hmm. Like, she didn't ask people and she didn't tell people
mm-hmm.
what she was thinking. She just kind of would think about it and do it.
Right, because she's keeping, we won't get into it in this first part, but she's keeping a big secret.
Yeah.
And she does keep this secret. She tells no one.
Yeah. And so maybe, you know, maybe that was really unusual for mm-hmm. women at the time. I think women maybe in the Victorian era weren't encouraged to do that.
Yeah. And she's young, you know, we meet her on her, you know, on or around her 18th birthday. She's really, like, fairly... you know, assertive and, you know, self-aware, I think, for 18. But we don't, I think the narrator makes a bigger case for her than what we actually witness. She's this, you know, spirited girl unlike others. And, you know, at any rate.
The adoration that the older men in the book mm-hmm. seemed to shower upon her did feel a little unwarranted
mm-hmm.
to me. It seemed ridiculous. Now, her mom, they just sort of allude to, but her mom is seen as extremely capable.
Mm-hmm,
like, when her husband died, mm-hmm. she managed everything. And they don't really, like, dwell on that, but she didn't train Rachel to manage everything, and she didn't give her the opportunity to manage everything, which is another sort of pivotal plot line, which is funny. So both Wilkie Collins' books have these inheritance structures.
Mm-hmm.
As pivotal plot lines.
And so there's also, okay, Rosanna Spearman, she's this unattractive servant. She has a prison record. She has a physical disability. She falls in love with a man outside her class. And she's given the space in this book to express that affection for him, which to me was astounding. Like, this character to me is almost as interesting as Marianne Halcombe in The Woman in White.
I really liked Rosanna. Mm-hmm. I did like her a lot. And I liked, you know, you noted here about how she doesn't think Rachel's even pretty.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not clear, like, is she just jealous? But it does sound like she makes a fair case. Like, if she was dressed like a servant, nobody would think a thing about her.
Yeah, like, if you put Rachel into servant's dress and took her ornaments off, what then?
Yeah, she'd just be like some skinny little nothing.
Right.
What Rosanna basically says.
I thought that was, I really am, still processing it, but blown away that Wilkie Collins gave space in these novels at the time these books were written to Marianne Helcombe and to Rosanna Spearman.
Tell me more about why that blows you away.
They are unconventional heroines or heroes of a Victorian novel. They are given a voice. They are given expression of affection, you know, caring, love, duty. They're both willing to die for the people that they love, and Rosanna actually does die.
Yeah.
She you know, disappears into the shivering sands. She's dead. And then, you know, in The Woman in White, Marianne Helcombe is ready to give her life for her sister. And, you know, Marianne Helcombe is unattractive. We hear it from every character.
Right. These unattractive women with, like, mm-hmm. the heart here.
You don't, in a Victorian novel, a woman, you know, with a physical disability, a woman who is unattractive, a woman with a prison record, these are not women given voices and major roles in books, generally speaking. And I love that Wilkie Collins gave each of these women a major role.
So I'm really curious here, because now that you sort of bring up that similarity, which wasn't apparent to me at first,
mm-hmm.
you have the main title guys, Franklin Blake and Walter Hartwright.
Mm-hmm.
They are kind of dismissive
mm-hmm.
of these women.
Yeah.
In being that these guys are the heroes, I don't know what to make of that in terms of the Wilkie's actual perspective. He includes the women, but he's also simultaneously dismissive of the women.
Yeah, I think he is, maybe to some degree. But I think Wilkie Collins likes the hero, because I think the hero, if I had to guess, you know, readers, tell me, you know, if you've read Wilkie Collins, you've studied the books, you know, please tell us.
Readers are always invited to give
always
opinions.
Invited. We want to hear what you have to say. I would guess that Franklin Blake, for example, is and Hartwright are both based on Wilkie Collins.
That's what I would guess, especially from the quote of things getting in the way of the writer. But mm-hmm. I dislike both of them so much.
But also, Wilkie Collins seems to really like these outsiders.
Yeah.
Like Ezra Jennings, Rosanna Spearman, the kid, Gooseberry.
Gooseberry, at the end.
He seems to have this odd or interesting affection for people who are outside the norm. And I think that's really interesting. So he seems to, like, have, you know, a foot in each world, right? Like, I get the swashbuckling hero, and I also get these people who don't really normally fit into the mainstream narrative.
Yeah, like, well it's like he likes them, but it's not at the sort of the deep heartfelt level mm-hmm. that I would say Dickens mm-hmm. would write the characters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when Dickens writes about the poor, or he writes about who was the poor kid that died in Bleak House?
Oh,
his name just fell out of my
goodness.
Head.
Oh, what is his
was
name?
Was it Billy?
No.
Mm-mm.
All right, we're going to come back to that. That's a
you know, but Dickens writes this character, the mm-hmm. street sweeper, little young, poor, dirty, ragged boy, and you just have heart for him.
Yes.
You know, you feel him deeply. You feel all of his characters, like, really deeply when he's writing about these outsiders.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like Wilkie Collins pulls them in and dismisses them a little bit.
Yeah.
They're very like, well, isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm.
Well, aren't they real people, too? Moving on. You know?
Right.
And we don't, like, find out, really, like, Gooseberry is clearly a hard case.
Yeah.
But he's kind of like, great, good job following, kid.
Right.
We're going to give you this weird name and a few, like, pounds for your trouble.
Right.
Move on.
And also, you know, the three Brahmins who are trying to reclaim the Moonstone, they're also arguably outsiders.
Yes, there's quite a bit of racism.
There's quite a bit of racism, so just heads up, readers. And there's also periodically, again, if you think differently or you think the same, let us know, there's an odd respect for these characters at times, these three Brahmins.
Yes.
So it's a foot in both worlds again. Like, Wilkie Collins is really deft at that. He's, you know, he's higher, you know, highfalutin, I can stand on high and look down on, and at the same time identify with, feel for, and respect. And it gets a little confusing at times.
Yeah. It brings me back to Miss Clack, who I don't want to just gloss over, because mm-hmm. she was definitely one of my favorite characters. Mm-hmm. You know, she is presented, I used the word sanctimonious, which I think is very much how she was presented.
Yeah.
And she's a little bit tone deaf, I would say, for sure. Mm-hmm. But also, I kept feeling like, well, she's not wrong.
Right, yes.
You know? Yes. Like, she'd come into a situation.
Right.
And all of these rich ladies who paid her no attention at all.
Right.
Did not even like her company. Mm-hmm. You know, they want her to do things.
Right.
And she points out the vanity.
Yeah.
As a narrator, the vanity that they're all, like, mooning over. Mm-hmm. And I was like, you know, she's right.
Yeah.
She's right here. You're all being kind of ridiculous.
There's glimmers of truth in a lot of the things she says. But if you just write her off as this sanctimonious busybody, then you won't see the truths that she's putting a spotlight on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really liked her.
And I think we're going to talk a little more about her as well in part two, because she plays a very big role in part two, whereas in part one, we know she's at a dinner party. But in part two, we really get her narrative and we see her sort of hiding behind a drape and overhearing it.
I was glad she got to be a narrator. That would be maybe a contrast with the Dickens that I keep contrasting to, where his sort of sanctimonious, telescopic philanthropist women are extremely two-dimensional, hard-headed.
Yes.
But getting inside Miss Clack's head, you can feel some sympathy for her perspective here.
Mm-hmm. So in the first part of The Moonstone, which is The Loss of the Diamond. So it focuses on really like this dinner party, this diamond that's going to go missing at the dinner party. And we're like launched right into the mystery of where did the diamond go? Who took it, et cetera. Did the Brahmins do it? Did a member of the dinner party do it? Did somebody outside the dinner party do it? And back to Gabriel Betteredge, who really dominates this first part. He says he has what he calls detective fever, where the horrid mystery hanging over us in this house gets in his head like liquor. He says it makes him wild. The detective fever, I think, I don't know, maybe Wilkie Collins had the detective fever. Gabriel Betteredge has it. Several other characters all get like embroiled into this detective story and try to figure it out, you know, how to solve the case and who did what, and everybody's interviewed and, you know, whispering behind closed doors kind of thing.
Yeah, I think, well, I think it's super duper common. And maybe, you know, I don't know, maybe back in the Victorian era, it was in poor taste, but I think it's just all pervasive now. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the concept of watching a train wreck and not being able to look away.
Yeah.
Which is almost, you know, even supposed news articles are crafted now. Everything's crafted to feel like a piece of clickbait. Mm-hmm. Like, what is the crazy thing we're going to tell you? What will happen next?
Right.
And it just winds up being something like weird, like somebody tweeted on Twitter, like Brad Pitt tweeted something today, right, and the end.
Yeah.
But it's like made into,
like it's some big deal.
Earth-shattering
new information.
It kind of capitalizes on our human weakness for these sorts of things. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I like the detective fever, because the reader also kind of gets into the detective fever. And I think that that's the sort of concept being introduced there is, okay, reader, there's going to be this big mystery here, and we got to ride, a wild ride come in, and it's not a small book, but it's going to be a fun ride. So the characters are in it, and as the reader, you're kind of in it as well. You're like, okay, there's a small number of people at this dinner party. You know, ostensibly, you know, the thief is one of the people in the house, you know, just
Yeah, and it was a good twist. We'll probably talk about that more in the next episode, but I really liked the twist that was there. Oh, clever.
And then, to close out this first part, let's just, call out the elephant in the room here, right? So this story starts where we learn this guy named John Herncastle killed several Indians and stole their sacred moonstone in India. He stole it contrary to a direct command and under threat of death. And when he died, the moonstone came out of hiding to be bequeathed to Rachel, John Herncastle's niece. At what point did the moonstone become British property? It was stolen and the theft comes to light when the thief dies. So why is there so much effort to keep this moonstone, to make sure Rachel has the moonstone, to make sure the Brahmins don't get the moonstone? And Sarah, I know you have an opinion on this, so I want to hear what you have to say.
Oh yeah, man, this was really troubling for me on levels. Mm-hmm. All right, so this Herncastle guy, this murderer, murders people again, and it's not because the British were just raiding everything. He disobeyed a direct command.
Yeah.
He murdered Indians. He stole the moonstone. Mm-hmm. His cousin almost witnessed him. Mm-hmm. He came in right as the Indians were dying, mm-hmm. And he's like, "Well, I didn't actually see it, so I won't report him." But then his whole family basically disowns him over it. Like, that is his alienation, is because they disown him over this, murderous thieving deed.
Yeah.
Until he gives the stone to his niece, and then suddenly...
it's legit.
It's like, oh, well, look at this great stone.
Yeah.
Well, it's mine now. These Indians are trying to steal my stone. These murderous Indians stealing my stone.
When I wear this beautiful gown, it looks so nice around my neck.
Get it back at all costs. Call the detectives instead of, what?
I know.
And that, it seemed like a pretty short turn. He kept it in hiding. It's the same people. It's not even another generation. His own sister, who wouldn't speak to him over the moonstone, gets the moonstone, and it's a different story.
Yeah.
So that was really weird. And of course, I would say it's still current today.
Mm-hmm.
It's still a topic of what is the British Museum going to do with all of the things from Greece?
Right.
And that's hundreds of years. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. Yeah, I don't know enough to even speak about it to be what was the original conditions under which these things were obtained.
Sure.
But we know right here, within one generation, it was murder.
Right.
It's not like it was purchased and it turned out to be a shiesty purchase.
Yeah.
It's straight up crime.
Right. But once it's bequeathed to Rachel, somehow it legitimizes this thing, and then
Now you can call the police, now you can throw these Indians in prison.
My jewel has been stolen, the moonstone is gone, and everybody in the book is now involved. They bring in the authorities, and everybody's trying to find this stone, and that initial crime seems like it's been forgotten.
Yeah, totally forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
The source of his alienation, not ideal. I don't know. I had a really hard time with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if we should just save talking about the ending till the next episode, but
we'll cover the ending.
I was like, I hope this goes the way I want it to, because this is too much.
Yeah. For me, in the second part feels, I think it wraps up, as we're going to find out, in a really interesting, sort of complicated way, which I like. I think it's worth talking about the ending of the book. When the first part ended, I really was a little bit, I was engaged in the story, page turn in, but at the same time I was thinking, there's a lot of emotional and legal investment in her ownership of this stone that,
she's just some kid.
Yeah.
She just turned 18 and she inherits this from her estranged uncle.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly we're calling the police, the ends they go to, getting in disguises, hiding it in banks.
Right.
To keep it from its rightful owners.
Right.
It's really weird to me.
And then you wonder, was he... So the stolen gem's supposed to carry a curse, right? So did he leave it to her? Because out of revenge?
Absolutely, 100%.
So here, yeah, this is my parting gift to you, and you're welcome. Bye-bye. You know, yeah. Here's the curse.
That was a revenge gift. The fact that they would even entertain that he would turn generous in his old age is weird.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so let's... We're going to get to the part two of the Moonstone in our next podcast episode. We have a lot more to cover. And in case you don't get to that episode in a timely fashion, do start reading The Mystery of a Hansom Cab. So tell us a little bit about The Mystery of a Hansom Cab.
Yeah, so The Mystery of a Hansom Cab was Australia's first literary sensation. Published in 1886, it sold hundreds of thousands of copies worldwide. Set in the charming and deadly streets of Melbourne, this thriller highlights class and social issues as a crime is committed by an unknown assassin. So I'm looking forward to it. Don't make the mistake I did and start reading The Big Bow Mystery, because that is not next.
Unless you just can read a lot of books at the same time, in which case you knock yourself out.
Yeah, which I cannot. I hardly like to even start another book until we do the podcast episode, because I like to keep my head in it.
But. Yes. It's so, I'm almost done with The Mystery of a Hansom Cab, and I'm really enjoying it. It's a fast read, 3 to 4 hours tops, page turner, super, super interesting, and a lot of conventions they're introducing there I've seen in book after book. And TV show, movie after movie, since this story was written, and it's kind of fun. It's set in Melbourne, which I think, you know, just it feels new, it feels fresh. So we've got another podcast episode about the Moonstone coming up, and we're going to cover in that one part two, which is the second period, the discovery of the truth.
All right. Thanks for joining us, listener. We appreciate you.
Yeah. Thank you very much.